Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're doing great. Thanks again for the comments and questions you've sent in. I'm going to reserve just a bit of time at the end of this seminar to address some questions and comments you've sent in. I'm going to also deviate a little bit from the outline in order to incorporate some things that you've mentioned and already sent in. One heads up for our seminar for next week, the final seminar. I want to invite you to submit questions, vignettes, case illustrations for us to discuss. Let me know beforehand. Send me an email so that I can structure the time and the topics that we want to further explore. As you know, and I've mentioned, the seminar four is not a formal presentation by me, but something that is evolving from a discussion, the things you've sent in, and mostly to look at some cases or vignettes, maybe even questions that each of you may have that could benefit you in your practices. So we have one vignette, one presentation already set up. I'll tell you about that next time and frame that. But I welcome anyone else who would like to do a vignette or offer a challenge or present a synopsis or a focus for a case. So let me know. Send me an email, and I'll give you a couple of guidelines and structure that. So thanks for everything you've sent in. I look forward to that really different kind of seminar next week. And remember, it's an extended time to allow time to look at cases. So anything any of you have right now, any questions or additions or comments that you'd like to add or ask now before we begin our third seminar and focus more on sustaining success, the psychology and neuroscience of that. To you, questions, comments, thoughts, I welcome any input. One last call, comments, questions, input, anything? I will then put us on lecture mode and reserve some time at the end for discussion and anything that you have that you want to add or ask or make more sense of, okay? Okay, we're going to be talking in this seminar about some aspects of sustaining success. Remember, the context here is the experiences and situations that your clients may not have had any encounter or experience in dealing with. Major changes, major transformations required that they have no operating model of what to do. And how can you then, uniquely, I think, as a mentor coach, help them deal with these situations? So, and this, I think, is one of the things we do uniquely in mentor coaching, is to help someone navigate change, transformation, and especially dealing with things perhaps never before encountered. So one consideration, the first thing I want to talk about, is mental representations. If you have an intuitive link, an intuitive sense of something, and you're working with a client, or just in your life, that intuition is based on a great deal of experience. You can't have intuition unless you have considerable experience. and mental representations and models to simulate something that may be unique or an instantaneous process, because an intuition begins instantly in the midbrain, and then it's moved to the left prefrontal cortex to make it make sense, logical, conscious, intellectual. So what most fundamentally underlies remarkable intellectual and athletic feats? And I want to tie that to intuition and mental representation. Here's an example. Softball pitcher Jenny Finch was a gold medal winner in the 2004 Olympics. She then challenged the best batters in professional baseball to hit her pitches. Remember, underhand, fastball, softball. Major League Baseball hitters were accustomed to hitting 95 to 97 mile an hour overhand fastballs, while the fastest underhand softball pitch is 67 miles an hour, and the softball is three times as big. Outstanding hitters took her challenge, actually kind of initially scoffed at it. Albert Pujols, the greatest hitter in a generation, was the first, followed by Brian Giles, Mike Piazza, Barry Bonds. They all struck out. In fact, none of them, except for one pitch, one time, actually barely tipped the ball, a small foul tip. So what accounts for the, and after that, when subsequent hitters saw what happened, they refused. They refused because they didn't want to be embarrassed or humiliated. So what accounts for the best batters in the history of baseball not being able to hit a softball pitch, a larger ball, coming at them 30 miles an hour slower than their accustomed baseball? Hold that answer, because I want to offer another scenario. Same question, different context. Both grandmaster and novice chess players were shown an entire chessboard with different configurations of pieces. In 5 seconds, a grandmaster chess player could recreate from memory an entire board. 5 seconds. After viewing the configurations for 15 minutes, a novice could only reproduce 50% of the chessboard patterns. 5 seconds, 15 minutes, master versus novice. And then when both expert and novice players were given a random assortment of chess pieces, configurations that would never appear in a real game, both expert and amateur performed equally. Being a grandmaster was no advantage with the random configuration. Why was this? Well, the professional baseball players and the amateur chess players did not have ingrained brain performance patterns, no mental representations. Both expert and amateur performed equally then. They had no mental representations that are developed in deliberate practice. Sustained deliberate practice can extend possibilities to what was not even previously considered, an entire skill set, physical, intellectual, artistic, becomes encoded into mental representations. These new brain performance patterns, and neuroscientists refer to these as chunks, ultimately become long-term memory. The growing ability to recognize and incorporate meaningful patterns in deliberate practice develops skills that increasingly become automatic and a part of performance flow. This is analogous to intuition. You develop an entire immersion in information, skill set development, and then can make a decision instantly at a midbrain level without processing it logically, consciously, intellectually. So these mental representations and instant simulations from them allow a chess master, a quarterback, an executive, or a farmer to glance at a situation and immediately recognize patterns to inform perception, processing, and action without even having to think about it consciously. These mental representations become hardwired in the brain as a default mode of performance flow. So the mind, brain, and performance sciences inform a systematic mindset as well as practice and execution for elite performance and achievement in deliberate practice. Mental representations are the pattern systems in your brain that organize a performance sequence and solidifies an identity and can be used, and this is the point here, beyond where you've ever been before. So mental models, mental representation, and patterns exist in the brain to create new simulations. So this is important as we begin to consider, what do you do with a situation for which there are no models, for which there has been no experience as yet, something you couldn't even have imagined? Hold that thought, because that's what I want to develop with you, because you'll each experience this in dealing with this question and this situation with clients, that minor or major decision making will involve this aspect of going from where they are to something new entirely and not feeling lost in doing it in a systematic way that you can help your clients develop this. So let's talk briefly about the neuroscience of attention. We're inclined to react to a situation more immediately when there's greater anxiety or stress, and this is in a new or never before encountered situation. A reaction is a quick and simple way of ending the anxiety and uncertainty to immediately convert it to an action. This can be very useful, but in a new situation can foreclose uncertainty and discomfort prematurely without really considering what's different, what needs to be addressed and considered now. So this action generates two interwoven brain responses, a narrowed, locked-in focus as the apparent cause, and then closure of cognitive consideration, a responsive, reactive pattern then narrows to intensify the focus and the inclination to immediate action. Now, when this is informed by the very useful mental representations and experience, it can result in an automatic flow. Think about an executive, an athlete, an artist can immerse in that flow and be informed in a way that is not stopping to think about it. A system can remind us to pause and choose rather than respond and react. This is what you may need to do with clients at points. A simple example. When we ask a client a question, it's a response to what was just said by that client to further explore. If, on the other hand, we suggest or give advice, it's a reaction to foreclose exploration for both coach and client. So it's something both coach and client want, but may not be in the best interest of either. It's an always present temptation to end any discomfort and uncertainty by giving advice. That also moves the point of reference from the client's story to the coach's story. Both the coach and client are immediately gratified, but that shift of the point of reference forecloses by inserting the coach's story with greater intensity and urgency, such as due to the stimulation of significant success or a remarkably different experience and need for decision. Reactions like this are more likely. With this intensity of focus and urgency to act, a more systematic approach can be especially helpful. This is a particularly where you'll be able to benefit your client. It's a reminder to pause and choose rather than respond and react. But during an intense time, the brain focuses on the immediate and on action to foreclose reflection and broader perspective. So with stress and uncertainty, for example, and especially excitement, really good or really bad experiences, an action response can foreclose that discomfort, but it may not result in the best choice. And that's what we specialize in as coaches, the choice architecture of this moment, of now and next. A more immediate and simple response may be to counter that reactive narrowing, to lock in an action sequence, to immediately broaden the focus, to zoom out, for example, for a wide-angle view, to counter an immediate action, which is narrowed and focused, and what's next. This broader perspective can include, for example, visualizing a successful completion of a specific scenario rather than immediate relief and enjoyment of an action sequence, or simply to zoom out to look at the bigger picture and to see how things look from that perspective. The visualization to counter that immediate urge to act may be the wide-angle view to consider what it would look like tomorrow, or what would you be pleased to have done a year or 5 years from now looking back. Let me think about that and get back to you is a decision. I'm going to sleep on that and get back to you. What I initially and subsequently heard many times from my wife that was very frustrating, but I learned to appreciate that, how we go through different states of mind by sleeping on it and have fresh eyes the next day in a different state of mind that's not reactive. Another example, the zoom out may be to look at what this $100 spent now online at Amazon for a shiny object would be if invested with compound interest 10 years from now, or the repeated doubling effect every 7 years at 9% in a retirement savings account. So, back to what we should be talking about. Attention is a limited resource. Power and prestige can compete and corrupt this reflective process. The stimulation of dopamine with fame, wealth, power can create its own state of mind. Each can be intoxicating. Each can lead to the need for more just to sustain the same pleasure, the hedonic treadmill. This is what we know now as a parallel example. When someone becomes addicted to something, it doesn't need to be a substance like a drug, but anyone can be addicted to a thing, a process, or a substance. Whenever we get addicted to something, the brain immediately constructs more neuronal receptors to deal with that so that it's metabolized, it's appreciated, but what that means also is it takes more gradually over time to have the same effect because more receptors metabolize it more quickly. And it's like what gave you pleasure 2 weeks ago, it will take a little bit more now to do the same thing, the hedonic treadmill. Daniel Kahneman described this. So this is something that's important to consider. The greater the deviation from a previous normal, as a result of remarkable success can determine the impact of all the components of that. We'll talk more about that. So attention directed to the self can lose focus, for example, on other people. Attunement to personal interest means less attention to the experience of others. A casualty of a shift to personal interest and this pleasurable experience is empathic attunement, and understanding of what others think and feel recedes a bit. The experience one's having means that the appreciation and attunement to others may recede. Remember, we talked about this in last seminar about hubris and the drawbacks of that. So let's look now at a systematic way, one way, to look at extreme success management. Many of you have heard and have seen applied the roadmap system that I use. The 7-step roadmap is the acronym for the 7 steps to understand the algorithms that go into decision making and look at how to revise or create a new system. Now, this is for you as coaches. This is not necessarily something you'll want to offer to your client, but something to inform your listening and your questioning, at least in the beginning. So, the 7 steps, the roadmap. Recognize the challenges for your client of self-regulation, of managing emotion and addressing the accompanying results. In this example, and the metaphor we're using for this series as representative for many others, extreme success and accompaniments of that may include wealth, fame, and power. Each has a different set of dynamics, but they're related in the sense of the challenge that we see as coaches and someone dealing with them. The 2nd step, own the opportunities that these accompaniments, money, fame, power, class, influence, recognition of these can offer as an opportunity to make a significant difference. In other words, to frame it, at least as you're thinking about it, to see how you want to proceed with your client about what's beyond the immediate stimulation and enjoy. You're not negating the achievement. You're not negating the pleasure, but you're also hoping to create a map to look at what else is there. And importantly, to help the client stay grounded in their own identity, their needs, and their ideals, their compass of true north, to not get lost in any of these accompaniments. Assess 3rd step. And this is all in the outline. Assess your ongoing groundedness in needs and ideals to remain consistent with purpose, to not get sidetracked by the accompaniments of significant success and its result. Humility and gratitude may be a consistent reckoning to stay aligned with needs and ideals. As part of that, and this may be a challenge in the headiness of success and the accompaniments or any situation that can feel overwhelming, decide 4 things, what to avoid, what to let go, what to keep, what to enhance. Map a systematic plan. The next to last step then, to author continuing fundamentals that created that success. In other words, don't abandon your game plan. Keep doing the things that generated success. And the challenge is to sustain that and continue the application of those principles despite all of the temptations to get lost in the heady experiences of everything that accompanies it. And finally, program an evolving and transforming identity still based on ideals, needs, and purpose with this evolving sense of self that incorporates the success and the adaptation to that, not losing that fundamental foundation of identity. Billie Eilish captured the intoxication of success, the habituation and wanting more of the hedonic treadmill in her song lyrics. Things I once enjoyed just keep me employed now. Things I'm longing for, someday I'll be bored of. Mental models with new algorithms of handling success require, and this is where you guys will earn your money, managing emotions, to think, feel, and behave differently in an unprecedented framework of experiences of your client. Some simple examples of clients with extreme success according to the timeline of that success. Here's one way of looking at it. Clients with extreme success, and I want to look at it from three perspectives with you. Gradual, sudden, and other than that, I'll elaborate. Gradual. Examples include professionals and business people with escalating wealth and the extrapolation of that and the success model. Another, sudden success. Examples include pro athletes or someone selling a business. And for this, there's no evolving model, perhaps no training or precedent or gradual accommodation to increasing prosperity. It's all of a sudden. This, I believe, is one of the greatest challenges of departing more quickly and more fully from a previous set of experiences, maybe even identity. And a third area, when someone has unlimited resources, being able to do or have whatever you want with no limitation, that's when you become aware of choices. Think about how there's a self-imposition of limiting restrictions that precludes any possibility of choice. Well, if I could afford this or if this were possible. When it's possible, when you can afford it, then it's a new situation to be able really to choose. So, considered, purpose, and the impact of decisions on wellness, spirituality, legacy. So, important in this process and in this roadmap to deconstruct how to understand what goes into creating a story, and especially important in terms of creating a new story that may be a significant departure from anything experienced. Recognize you can't assess and change what you don't see. This is what we listen for in our clients, for that 90 to 95% of their operating model that they're not hearing, that they're not recognizing, so that we can help them look at that, develop greater awareness and empathic appreciation for themselves. We look with them at blind spots, at inattention blindness, at unconscious biases. So this means that achievement of success and sustained performance, whatever that is, professionally, artistically, sports, is not about fame or money or accolades. It's about being loyal to yourself, sticking with a model of your own purpose, your own needs and ideals. Think of purpose and the experience of satisfaction, of mastery and pride, and how an evolving identity can incorporate successful achievement and provide a framework for each accomplishment. Remember, we've talked before about one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful force of the human psyche is our identity, our bedrock identity. And we always return to that so that if you help a client create a change, unless that's incorporated into the transformation of their identity, they're going to revert back to what they did before. So that's why it's always helpful to have that bedrock of identity, basic needs and ideals in clear focus to help the client incorporate that so that they can evolve in an accepting way to transform their identity to be consistent with that and especially be aligned with their needs and ideals that will shift over time. The needs may shift over time, but the ideals are going to remain invariant regardless of the money, fame, or stimulation that comes with it. So, performance is your legacy. A part of that legacy is successfully dealing with the accompaniments of success itself. It's the foundation of identity passed on transformationally and epigenetically to those you touch, teach, interface, and mentor coach. How do you build on what you've already done? How do you build on what you've never done? What does it take? Consider this. What does it take to sustain power, fame, success? There are some fundamentals, but how would you answer that? Think about it. What would it take to sustain the success and not be waylaid by any of the accompaniments? Here are some possibilities. Continue the deliberate practice and performance. Use a growth mindset to say, what's next and how can I be better? Be consistent with identity. Prioritize others' interests as much as your own. Do not get lost in the success and the hubris of success to write your own rules or lose touch with others. Remain empathic and focused on the experience and well-being of others. The antithesis of success toxicity, gratitude, generosity, benevolence. When success is unprecedented and beyond what was imagined, the innate pattern recognition in the brain has no map. There's not the kind of intuition based on cumulative sets of experiences and a flow. There may be few or no mental representations for handling the results for remarkable success. Think about it even in a simple way. I heard Kareem Abdul-Jabbar say when he had his first baby, all of my life experiences offer me nothing about what to do now with this baby. I feel lost. That's a prototype example of a situation that no matter how much you know, it's still a new and different situation. There's no map. There's no mental representations of experience for handling results as for other remarkable successes. The primary and sustained challenge is to continue in a systematic way of dealing with basic components that generated that initial success, applied differently, evolving, but the fundamentals are there to not be waylaid, especially by the excessive stimulation of the results. So let's boil this down to three key elements to managing extreme success. And this is oversimplification, but it's three key elements to keep in mind. Sustain a growth mindset, meaning to help your client stay focused on that for continuing effectiveness and not getting lost. Self-regulate all the aspects of the results of that success. And thirdly, consistent attunement to internal needs, ideals, and purpose. The two fundamental aspects of that bedrock of identity, needs and ideals. Needs will change and evolve over time. Ideals will remain the same and can be met in various ways, perhaps new ways, but that bedrock of ideals will likely remain the same. So let's use an example here of sudden wealth. The greater the discrepancy between early money messages, money story development, and subsequent sudden wealth, the greater the challenge is likely for adaptation and comfortable management of sudden wealth. Attachment patterns to significant others, as well as to behavior patterns, including relationships with money, become hardwired in the brain. They're part of that 90 to 95% of the operating system that's unconscious that generates our automatic responses and decisions. But in a new situation, automatic may not work, and it may even impede with flexible adaptation of moving ahead. Entertainers and athletes share with lottery winners the sudden excitement and stress of an instantaneous multimillion-dollar event. Learning to manage the feelings that come with significant amounts of money is crucial to sustaining that wealth. The brief period that athletes and entertainers make significant money that has to last for a lifetime is an example of the practicality of that. So let's look then with this illustration at sudden wealth strategies. Research on the psychological impact of sudden wealth found that one of the most positive adaptations was self-reflection to search for present significant meaning. The introspective process, and this is what we foster as coaches, focuses on meaning and possibility, and then plans that incorporate someone examining their performance story and behaviors to determine what they want to keep, what they want to change, what they want to enhance, and let go. The study also found a positive relationship between altruism, helping others and charities, and positive adaptation to sudden wealth. Positive adaptation to the sudden acquisition of wealth was related to collaboration with financial, legal, and mentor-coach professionals, because this is a new situation and different perspectives may need to help inform how to proceed. Sudden wealth and financial windfalls, like an unexpected inheritance, a lottery, gambling, or IPOs, can result in overwhelming guilt for the recipient. After countless hours of practice and preparation of a craft or skill, especially in professional athletes and entertainers, can be, and I've heard this directly, a survivor's guilt. Like someone who survives an accident or a horrible experience understandably questions why their lives were spared and feel guilty, in this instance, about their good fortune, and they suddenly far surpass the people they know and their family. it becomes immediately necessary to address this guilt, since there's been no harm caused to others or anything bad that the recipient's done. Carl Menninger put it simply, save guilt for real sin. Sudden wealth with survivor's guilt may be prompted by receiving an amount of money that is simply unprecedented, with no models for how to deal with that or having experienced it beyond what anybody in the family or friends may have ever achieved. So it becomes imperative to reframe the guilt so it doesn't lead to detrimental financial behaviors or some other actions based on the experience of guilt. So in coaching, here's a very simple model to deal with guilt. To successfully deal with guilt, you either have to change your action or your belief. If you're doing something that makes you feel guilty, then you're going to have to change your action. If you believe something that is not working but yet generates guilt, you may look at changing your belief. And this survivor's guilt is an example of this. You know, I ain't done nothing wrong. But that saying it, as you know, saying it doesn't make it so. It becomes imperative to reframe this guilt so it doesn't lead to detrimental financial behaviors or other reactions based on this experience of guilt. And again, money, finances, this is only an example. Use this same principle to apply to other things that you'll hear in coaching. But to continue this example, lower socioeconomic backgrounds, including the struggles of parents to support athletic, intellectual, or artistic pathways before the person achieves that wealth, can simply amplify the result. A producer-songwriter, I can't say more for confidentiality, landed a $35 million publishing contract. As with many athletes and entertainers, the amount of his deal became public knowledge, which made it extremely hard to say no to family and friends who wanted help. His generosity ranged from paying a friend's rent, sharing his wealth with friends and family, even acquaintances who asked for help before he requested help with mentor coaching. So management to sustain extreme success can include not only self-regulation and self-reflection, but revisiting or perhaps even creating the first time a systematic plan to deal with the accompaniments of success. Additionally, keep in mind that an evolving revision of mental representations may need to incorporate significant ongoing growth and success, alignment with needs, ideals, and purpose, which is to say identity, while undergoing transformation, can still be part of that compass. Management to sustain extreme success is that self-regulation and self-reflection at its core, and then the revision of a systematic plan to deal with what's new and different, especially an attunement and our awareness of how to help a client develop mental representations that may need to incorporate significant growth and success beyond where they've ever imagined before. So they're having to deal with all the accompaniments, but how to sustain it, how to grow it, alignment with needs, ideals, and purpose, identity, while undergoing transformation can be that compass. Self-reflection to sustain focus in the face of extreme success can be really important. Think of this as you're working with clients, as you ask, what's next? Or perhaps even more specifically, now what? Consider the impact of others and beyond that the client may not have considered the legacy. You always are a model that's being downloaded by others. Make sure that's a consideration and that you get it right, at least for now and what you can know. So one way to think about that is to consider success temporary and legacy ongoing. So here's something I'd like you to do. I'm going to ask a series of questions. I'd like you to write down your immediate answer to these questions. Immediate answer. When you consider the people and behaviors that represent respect, admiration, ideal achievement, whose behavior did you most admire and use as a model? Who did you admire but not try to imitate? Who was your favorite writer, athlete, business person? Who did you most envy? Who did you most imitate in terms of conversation or communication? If you could be respected and praised by one person in your life, who would that be? In the whole history of mankind, what one person would that be? When you think, what will someone think of me? Who do you think of first? When you do what you do, who do you imagine seeing you and smiling in approval? Who would you most like to praise your accomplishment with acknowledgement and words? If some famous person were to reference you and praise something about you, who would that be? And the final question, what would that be about? Your answers are components of your ideal. Some related aspect of focused attention. Our culture determines the context of behaviors that become attractive and idealized. We adopt our behaviors regarded as praiseworthy by the culture we're in, those that fit with our tribe. We initiate habits of those close to us, the tribe who we most admire. How can you define what is enough for you without becoming limiting of future success and expansiveness? Consider this for yourself first, and then, if it's applicable, to a client. Enduring power relies on empathic resonance and connection with others. Stories can help unite individuals in a common cause. Stories are how we make sense of things, how we communicate to others, how we create a community of understanding. The more we engage with a person, the less it becomes a category and stereotypical. For example, when people donate to a charitable cause, it's not to save the lives of tens of thousands of children, but the best story is how you can save one child. You can be the hero. For example, donation increased when moving from the abstract to the specific. A famine in Ethiopia was significantly enhanced by 25% of donation when provided a picture of Roika, a 7-year-old who faces a threat of severe hunger and even starvation. We're moved by stories of trauma or success of a person we've never met. The death of Bambi's mother can affect us emotionally more than the combined deaths of unnamed and unknown masses of people or animals. The more we come to know someone, the more real they become. Feeling resides in specificity and detail as well as engagement. If it remains an abstraction, there's way less engagement. The protagonist of the story, whom we have come to know and engage, has much more meaning than the unnamed people who we don't have detail or knowledge about and have less connection with. remote drone pilots, after decimating a number of lives with a drone strike, get in a car, go to the store to get some milk, and go to home to have dinner with their families. Nazi doctors, after perpetrating deaths and atrocities, would come home and play with their children. Inhibitions decrease as distance increases. The distance and anonymity are beneficial, for example, for physicians who do not treat people they know because of potential loss of objectivity. Surgeons operate in a specific field, an exposed part of the patient's body, with the remainder, including the head, covered. Healthcare workers who humanize their work with patients tend to have higher degrees of stress and burnout. I realized much later that the three medical students who worked on a cadaver with me for several months in the first semester of medical school, we never once thought of that cadaver as someone's grandmother. Those who feel pressure but feel that they have a determination over the situation can feel effective and positively utilize to enhance performance. Dr. Robert Sapolsky, Stanford biologist, had found that stress is not only a crucial tool, but in survival, it can enhance performance. Stress can optimize biological responses to enhance performance. This is a benefit of the stress of significant success. High demand, low cortisol, can generate a stressful response. Situations that are intense and have high demand, when framed as challenge and pleasurable, can frame this as a positive outcome and pursuit. When passion and intensity are accurately framed, it doesn't become stress. So, our challenge here, in a conclusion, because I want to reserve just a bit of time for your thoughts or questions. How well we understand our own stories, our life, wellness, money, career, relationship, performance stories, guides our life and work and determine our ultimate success. It also plays a major role in our connection, our empathy of others, our influence of and by others, especially our clients. It determines how much of a difference we make with ourselves, those important to us, and in the world. This understanding informs how we relate to ourselves and to one another and our clients. Our understanding and our wisdom may be illuminated and planned to roadmap those patterns, to wisely perceive and shape the patterns into the narrative of our stories. So as mentor coaches, what will you do with your influence, your persuasion, your power? And abiding question here that I want to close with. Despite whatever measure of time, money, or accolades, which may be temporary, think of your purpose, satisfaction, pride, mastery. These are not only your immediate orienting experiences, these are your legacy. We're in discussion mode now. I'm interested to hear any thoughts, responses, or questions to any part of this, or any clarifications of anything. What would be helpful for us to talk about a bit more? You may be seeing over our discussions how this relates to that single page that I sent with the initial email to you about the vampire problem and how we need at times to make decisions for which we have no clue and no precedent, no experience. So how do you go about that? There are no mental representations or models. There's nothing to base a simulation on. So what can be orienting? And in those decisions, we may have to go back to foundational elements of our identity, our needs, and our deals and ideals, and help clients to do that, especially when there are such heady and exciting, or at other times, really challenging, painful times that may be lost. And this is where we as coaches can help someone become more aware of their story and empathic resonance with themselves, and help them navigate a story for now and next in a more systematic way. Thoughts or questions? I'm eager to hear what has been helpful to you. If anybody would like to share that, is there a sentence any of you has about what has been most helpful or useful for this seminar that you'd like to share with others? I think that's always beneficial because it's always a bit different. Anyone? I'm getting a little lonely, guys. Anybody want to respond to that? When you assess, as coaches, when you assess experiences that may be so different with your client that they have absolutely no clue, a couple of questions that you may consider that may be helpful. What's the last most successful experience you dealt with that was beyond what you had imagined or experienced? So there may be a kind of vestige of a model for that. Another potential question, what personal tools did you rely on or create to deal with that experience for yourself? And even perhaps a third question, what was the best practice that you created to successfully deal with your situation and your experience? So to look at something similar, mostly to kind of pose self-reflective questions that can help a client become empathic with himself or herself, and to look at positively framing an experience, even in some way related that they dealt with successfully, helps them to engage perhaps in a positive approach to a current situation. Now, sometimes think about also how your client may be experiencing the extremes of a new situation. We're dealing with what's more fun to talk about here, the major successes and the accompaniments of success. There may also be unprecedented challenges, painful times, losses, for which a client has no model of how to deal with as well. For some clients who got feeling bad down, the greatest challenge is to stay with feeling good. So keep that in mind as well. But the need for a resonance empathically, the co-creation of a new story from where the client is now, and to look at that in a systematic way, with the client developing their own story, each coaching session can be a model for the other 7 days and 23 hours that you're not there talking with the person, because they're downloading a model of how to approach something, a systematic way to shrink the change, to look at what's next, and to create a system to deal with what they're dealing with. So I'm interested in having you send me an email to indicate what kind of challenges or questions you'd like us to discuss in our final seminar. If you have a case or a vignette to present, send that to me. Remember, it's going to be up to you guys. I'm interested in following your lead and your needs on this rather than doing a presentation. So send me those cards and letters and emails about what would be most helpful for us to talk about. If you have a vignette or a case, send that to me, and we'll craft a way to develop a more focused kind of supervision or mentor coaching with that that will benefit everyone. So let me know, and I want to create something that's of most use to each of you. Thanks very much, and I appreciate your communication and kind words. Have a great rest of the week. I look forward to picking up right here next time. See you guys. Bye now.